Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the Planet Football Podcast. I am Grant Wall here on a foggy, rainy New York Monday morning with Luis Miguel Echegaray. How are you doing, buddy?
It's a foggy, rainy Monday. I just made that song up.
Your singing voice is much better than that. Truly.
Acting school, my friend. Theater background.
We will devote an entire episode of this podcast at some point to Luis Miguel's acting career and acting school. We may even track down some clips.
Please don't. For the sake of humanity, don't.
Lots to talk about, as always, because the soccer world never stops. First off, Megan Rapinoe is the 2019 Sports Illustrated Sportsperson of the Year. Very deserved, in my opinion. I would guess yours.
Absolutely. That was me clapping. I hope our producer, Harry, will add some applause when I'm doing that. What can you say? I mean, to me, it was a no-brainer. Congratulations to Megan Rapinoe, recent winner of the second ever Ballon d'Or in the women's game. Obviously, the World Cup, where she won both Best Player, Golden Boot. But it's not just about that. It's about what she represents as a person who stands up for what she believes in. And I'm going to be very honest here. There is no doubt in my mind that if you read the tweets from SI's announcement of Megan Rapinoe, there's going to be
the bros.
The bros, right? The
bros don't like it.
The trolling who, you know, in my opinion, and I know you share this sentiment, it all comes down to insecurity. It all comes down to some kind of base that says, I'm laughing at this point because it's anything but fueling, you know, not just Megan Rapinoe, but those who support, you know, things that are more important than just the game. We love this game. We all do, and we love sports, but life is bigger than that. And I think that Megan Rapinoe represents that.
Well, and that's why she's carrying a sledgehammer on the cover.
Right. And it's a beautiful photograph.
Yeah.
And it's a great piece by Jenny Ventus. And also, by the way, my friend, a great essay from you and the podcast that you did with Jenny. It's just, we're all here to really celebrate not just who Megan Rapinoe is, but what she's trying to do. That, to me, is the biggest thing. And I congratulate her.
Yeah, check out the podcast. It's a special bonus podcast that went up today, me interviewing Jenny Brentis about her terrific story, which you also should read.
She's also the fourth woman in the award's history to receive it, which
fourth,
says a lot.
Fourth standalone woman ever to win the award in the 65 years of Sports Illustrated. Obviously, that's too small a number, but it is growing. I do think history will... as time goes on, even more so, view Megan Rapinoe kindly in 2019 and her role in using her platform while at the same time performing at the highest of world-class levels.
Yep.
Other things to talk about, by the way, because we had a very busy weekend. We're going to talk about 14 points now, Liverpool over Man City, 8 points over Leicester. Manchester Derby obviously won by Man United over City, surprisingly, this weekend. We're going to talk about Liverpool's victory. We're going to talk about Leicester. We're going to head over to Europe. Barcelona getting things going again. Bayern losing again in a crazy race in Germany. That's a lot of fun. We're going to get to North America. We're going to talk about Ernie Stewart's Chicago-only my way or the highway policy for U.S. soccer coaches and why that's not good. We're going to talk about the Liga MX final, which is now set between Club America and Monterrey. We're going to look ahead to Champions League this week, final group stage games, and in particular, one fascinating one, Jesse March's Red Bull Salzburg hosting Liverpool, and Jesse March's team can knock out the reigning European champions with a victory, and if they do that, Salzburg would advance, which is a pretty incredible achievement just to get to the point in the final group stage game where Salzburg could do this.
And this was no easy group.
Napoli as well. So, yeah, it's pretty incredible. But let's talk about Premier League here to start, as we typically do. And coming into this week, my friend, Manchester United, I thought this might be Ole's last week because they had midweek Tottenham with Mourinho, former Man United coach, coming in. Then they had to go to the Etihad to play Man City in the rivalry game. And if you had asked me last week when we were sitting here, I would have said 0 points from this week for Man United. Ole's done.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was saying. I was thinking about, okay, Pochettino's now planning his reintroduction to the Premier League, and I want to officially state my apology to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Manchester United, because as you mentioned, in the space of a week, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has now defeated Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola, and this Manchester United team, specifically the Manchester Derby, came out to fight. And they came out to play well, and they came out to do the good things at the Etihad. Players like Fred, who I have been criticizing for a long time, was really outstanding. Obviously, the partnership with McTominay did a lot. This is a young team, you know, taking in mind outside of your experienced players like Ashley Young or even David De Gea. This is a young team that's trying to get it, and they did everything correctly. They punched Man City in the face, right? That Mike Tyson comment, everybody has a plan until you punch them in the face. That's literally what Manchester United did. They knew that Guardiola is all about possession, trying to control the final third, and United just attack them on the counter every time. Martial's goal was a sneaky one, sneak pass to Edison. It was just an overall really good performance. It's not, to me, there's still a long path towards Manchester United and what they need to do in order to once again, you know, call themselves a title challenger. That we're still way from that. But this is a very good week, and there's a lot to be said for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And I think, hopefully, this is for Manchester United and the supporters, this is the beginning of something that you can once again reclaim as what Manchester United used to be.
I think you're putting this in the right context, because it is just two games. It's two monster games for them, where they get 6 points when most people thought zero was going to happen. But you look especially at the City game, and even both games, actually. I mean, Man United plays better against better teams.
Yeah.
And part of it, especially against City, seems to be that Man United's better on the counter. If you actually ask Man United to initiate, they're not that good at that. They're actually pretty poor at that. It kind of makes me think back to, you know, what do certain teams do well? In the World Cup final, France was a counter-attacking team, and they won. And I do think we're in a phase maybe now of world soccer where that's happening a bit more often, that teams are relying on that. And it doesn't need to be embarrassing to play that way.
I think that in any sport, you can add this, in order to win, to be successful, aside from adding all the, you know, tactical, you know, factors that you want to put in as a coach, I think the most important thing, and it kind of comes from the, you know, Bill Belichick philosophy in many ways, is not necessarily highlight your strengths, but take away your opponent's weaknesses. And that's what Manchester United did this week. And as you said, the counter-attacking philosophy almost always is that. It's trying to say, we know what you're going to bring. We're not even going to try and be better at you at that. But we're going to try and nullify every single thing that you're good at in order for us to counter. And that's what Manchester United does. And that actually is what Liverpool does.
Yeah.
Liverpool really obviously has a philosophy and a strategy, but it's so good at taking away the strength of the opponent. And that's what I think, you know, you can see in the modern game more often than not. And as you said, France in last year's World Cup.
I do want to be clear. I don't think things are fixed at Man United just because they won these two games.
No. Right? That's not what we're saying. I mean, I began my sentence by saying we're not calling them a title challenging team. But what I saw this week was something that we haven't seen in the past. Not even when Solskjaer won against PSG last year.
Right.
What I'm seeing now is a cohesive unit, at least this week, saying, and you mentioned it, playing against big teams and delivering. Now Manchester United has to be consistent. And you have to be on the roll to do it.
And this is also the point where I remind everyone that Man United has the highest wage bill of any team in the Premier League and shouldn't be an underdog ever.
I mean, you know, they have a Europa League against AZ Alkmaar, then a home to Everton, then a League Cup game against Colchester, Watford, a home to Newcastle, Burnley. These are all winnable matches. There are no excuses if you just saw what you just saw from this week.
Not even Duncan Ferguson's mighty Everton?
If I've ever seen a team that replicates how a player used to play like, that was literally what I saw this weekend. That was incredible.
Everton, by the way, beating Chelsea after Marco Silva let go and Duncan Ferguson comes in on interim. And I don't think he really does have a chance to get the full job. He shouldn't, based on what he's done before. But you never know.
Well, it was a Duncan Ferguson performance. Yeah. If you ever remember from how he used to play, you know, he gave you 150%. It wasn't always pretty, but, you know, he gave you everything. And that's, you know, you saw that, you know, the foul count on Everton was so high, but it was so physical. I just loved it when he would hug every ball boy after every goal. That was great to see. But I'm with you. I don't think he has the job. I mean, there's talks of David Moyes coming back, who obviously knows.
I don't know what to say.
Well, I mean, I think there's a historical, from 2002 to 2013, I believe he was there. You know, so it's a long relationship with them. There's also Unai Emery that's interested. Maybe a report saying that he was even maybe approached by it. We don't know. But what I think, like you, is I don't think Duncan Ferguson has the job for the long run.
Let's just say this is the best ball boy season ever.
This is the ball boy season.
It really is. Yeah. I hope this becomes just a common thing every week where managers are running around hugging ball boys.
It's just great.
Let's talk Liverpool. 3-0 easy win at Bournemouth, which is terrible right now. And here's a situation where Liverpool, as we mentioned earlier, has a big game on Tuesday, the early game, 12:55 p.m. Eastern against Salzburg. Sadio Mane didn't see here. So, you know, this was a lineup where Naby Keita looked good, by the way. And you got a sense of how the depth of Liverpool is better, to be honest, than the depth of Man City, because we've seen Liverpool have injuries, put other guys in, Fabinho's out, Keita comes in, plays well, I think it's his first start of the Premier League this year, scores a goal, and they just keep winning.
Yep, I think that's the difference. I think the difference is now, as opposed to last season, is that now this isn't just a good, when we talked about Liverpool, we talked about a strong, talented, willing starting 11. We're now talking about a squad that's able to just come in. I mean, Divock Origi did it in the Merseyside derby. You mentioned Keita. You know, they put in Curtis Jones in this game. You know, it was just a solid win. You know, they have an important game in the Champions League. But now you're seeing a squad, and that's going to be key, especially these next 2 weeks, because they have the Club World Cup and all these matches. But, you know, again, another strong win and another, you know, just testament to Jurgen Klopp and what he's done with not just a starting 11, but a squad.
Yeah. By the way, this was the best weekend of back heels we've seen in a long time because we'll talk about Luis Suarez and his goal later, but the Mo Salah back heel pass when he's got three defenders draped on him in a give and go to Keita for his goal, incredible.
Yeah, it's what separates him from a great player to a top three, top five. That's just what separates, you know. And that, I mean, I know we'll talk about Suarez's back heel because that was just unbelievable. But yes, the last back heel in this particular game was fantastic.
Let's mention Heung-min Son's goal for Spurs. Which
how can you not?
Like, in most of you have probably seen this goal, but if you haven't, please look it up. And notice where he gets the ball. He is literally at his own penalty box.
I don't know.
And then runs the whole freaking field.
I don't think we're going to be able to talk about it and do it. It's just poetry. And it's a mixture of everything that we remember from Maradona to a Messi goal a few years ago, you know, but this was just beautiful. And I tweeted, I remember when it happened, I said that something that's amazing about Son is that, first of all, again, I put my hand, well, right now I do, because I said that if there was a player that might struggle under Mourinho, it might be Son, and it's kind of been the complete opposite. So I might as well just hand in my quitting papers to Sports Illustrated. I'm sorry, I'm really not an expert at all. I'm just guessing here. But no, something that I said in terms of this goal is that usually what he does is when he receives the ball, he either goes wide or he penetrates just outside you know, the penalty box in order to provide to whether it's Harry Kane or Moda or somebody else. This time he was like, no, this is all me. And it was unbelievable. The amount of pace, ability to control the ball so close, the finish, everything. What a goal. Incredible.
And I know people are going to say, you know, poor defending. But you know what? If that's what your takeaway is from this goal,
well, you're such
a
negative.
Go away. Go away. Yeah. Seriously.
I mean, that's just half glass empty. Like, come on.
Because the bursts of speed on the ball that Son had in this goal, and then the ability to have the composure, because try doing this, everyone. Try running 80 yards, 90 yards, whatever it was, and having the presence of mind to then shoot with accuracy.
Yeah. It's just an unbelievable goal. And if you don't say anything else but that, please go away.
5-0, by the way, in that game against Burnley for Spurs.
Yeah, so big
Spurs
statement.
Comes back from the United loss. And Leicester's a team that we really do need to talk about, because at this point, I think you make a really good point here. It's like they fully deserve to be in second place. This is not some fluky thing. It is why I'm getting a little annoyed when I see the description of the title race being, oh, it's a 14-point lead for Liverpool over City. Okay. But it's 8 over Leicester. And it's not like they haven't earned those points.
So as Grant mentioned, some of the things that we do here in the podcast, we obviously do extensive notes before the taping. And one thing that I mentioned was, to me at this moment, it's clear as day that the second best team in the Premier League is Leicester City. I watched them obviously against Aston Villa this weekend, and it's the best team that Aston Villa has faced. I'm telling you right now, and Liverpool's already come to Villa Park. It's visited Man City.
So you're saying, wait, so Leicester's a better team than Liverpool?
I'm saying that in the performance.
Oh, okay. Against
Villa, it's the best team that, to me, okay, Aston Villa has faced. I think that the best team in the Premier League is Liverpool, and a clear second is Leicester City.
Yeah.
I think that some of the things that Brendan Rodgers, I mean, we can talk all about Jamie Vardy, who's just playing out of his mind right now, and we can talk about James Maddison and just the offensive chemistry that's going on. But something that's clear from the title-winning team and even from a Brendan Rodgers squad before Leicester City is the fact that they're so good defensively.
Yeah.
They are so good. And I'm not just talking about the defenders. I'm talking about as a team, how they defend. They've only conceded 10 goals in the Premier League. That's really remarkable for a team who just loves to attack and attack. The way that they pass the ball in the final third, the way that they understand each other is just incredible. They're really good on set pieces. They don't give you a sniff of the ball if you're trying to attack Schmeichel, and they are the second best team in this league for sure. And if there's somebody that's rivaling Liverpool right now, it's by far, it's not Man City, they're third, it's Leicester City for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, comparing this even to Leicester's title-winning team, this is a better team.
No, I think they are. I think tactically, when you watch them and what they do, listen, the title-winning team, it will go down in history.
Sure.
We all know that, but I think it was more to do with, you know, this do-or-die mentality that every time they went on that pitch, they killed themselves.
And if we're being honest, poor performances that season by a number of top teams.
Correct. Whereas what you're seeing now is a team that you can say, this is a Champions League qualifying team. This is a team that can rival Liverpool for the title. They're playing really good stuff. The statistics are proving that, offensively and defensively. So that to me says, and in talent, overall talent, this is a better team than the title winning team.
You know, people are so quick to want to say, oh, the title race is over. And I'm still holding out against saying that, but if it gets to be a double-digit lead for Liverpool on everybody, including Leicester, I think it's going to be very hard for Liverpool not to win the title.
Listen, I'm not going to go against math and numbers. So unless it's until it's mathematically impossible, I'm not going to say it's done. But this seems like a mountain.
And this weekend especially.
Yeah.
You're just like, okay.
This seems like a mountain. And I know that every single Liverpool fan right now is saying, shut up, please be quiet. But this is no longer like last year where, you know, the January lead was strong, single digit, you know, towards the end of the month, and then, you know, Man City came back. This is a substantial lead where you just don't see any cracks. And it's not impossible for either Leicester or Man City to come back, but it's almost, I think.
Man City is very disappointing to me. Losing Laporte should not have had this big of an impact, but it has.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I'm reading the comments from Guardiola after the game.
He just seems sour right now.
I don't think there's an excuse here. I mean, you have the money, you've had the plan, you've had the projections, and I think not deepening the squad was a big mistake. And like you said, this is like a sour, you know, bitter. And yes, it's like we said, it's almost impossible, but it's not over. And what are you going to do to fight back? And it just at this moment, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
You want to talk a little bit about the bottom of the table, which makes sense. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's funny because when you look at the bottom of the table, you look at 11th placed Arsenal, who, as we speak, still has to play West Ham later this afternoon, is on 19 points. And 18th Southampton, the 18th place, as well as Aston Villa, who have joined points, but Villa is on a better goal difference, is on 15 points. There's a 4-point difference between 11th and the relegation. And the disparity between like what's going on in the bottom half to the title-winning race is unbelievable. So all it takes is this Christmas period, this holiday period, to kind of switch so many things around. So even though we see Watford, Norwich, and Southampton in the relegation zone, things could look different for any of them.
We could see some really good, like, respected teams, like big-ish teams in the relegation zone, potentially.
I mean, we talked about Everton's win against Chelsea, which, you know, was commendable, and the euphoria was great, but, you know, they still have to play. They're on 17 points in 14th place. Aston Villa is only above it on goal difference. West Ham has 16 points as we speak. Burnley, 18. Brighton, 18. Arsenal on 19. I don't care how big you think a team is. At this point, there is no from 11th to 20th, because Newcastle did come away with a good win, and they're on 22, so we have to make a little difference. They're on 10th. There is so much room for that bottom half to just completely change in the next 2 weeks.
By the way, this isn't about the bottom of the table. It's more about Chelsea. They've lost 3 out of 4 now in the league after going through a really nice run, and it's also coincided with Christian Pulisic falling off after a really good run. So,
it's a young squad. Right?
But I mean, like, Man United's now in 5th after their 6-point week. And so things can change a lot in that middle to bottom level very quickly right now in a way that we aren't going to see at the top of the table. Let's move over to Europe and talk about Barcelona, 5-2 over Mallorca. And another hat trick from Leo Messi in ridiculous goals, as he often does.
I don't know what to say about this game. Like, if you watch the highlights,
the highlights are pretty great.
Antoine Griezmann's opener was fantastic.
Great ball from Ter Stegen on that one.
And we could have talked all day about just that goal. Yeah. And then the goals keep coming. Like you said, the hat trick from Lionel Messi. I mean, at this point, what else can you say? Unbelievable. And then Luis Suarez back heel.
How did that not defy the laws of physics?
I don't know. It was unbelievable, the angle from where he took the back heel, how it went round the keeper, the fact that he knew all along what he wanted to do. It was an unbelievable goal.
Why do I feel like that's like a South American goal? Like the kind that, I mean, I haven't seen anyone else do that type of goal for a long time, if ever, But
like exotic? We're exotic people, Grant. We like to score exotic.
I can't imagine some European dude scoring that goal.
Well, I mean,
is
maybe.
That bad? Is that me sort of anti-European?
You're going to get some angry
messages from
Dutch and Spanish players. No, I mean, I know what you're saying, like just the audacity to even try that. But I think it's more about Luis Suarez. Just obviously we've mentioned about Lewandowski, but Luis Suarez is obviously a player. Just if he didn't play with Messi, he would be somewhere else completely dominating that squad. I mean, he is already with Barcelona, but just what he does as a finisher is unbelievable.
I just want to make sure that I got what I saw. He backheeled it into the ground, and then it went up?
I'm watching it right now.
Because, like, it's just such an insane finish.
So, first of all, he's not facing goal.
Right.
Hence the back heel. Second of all, he's not right in front of goal. Right? It's not like the keeper's out, it's one-on-one, and he just backheels around him. He is at an angle.
Right.
Going against the goalkeeper and the defenders, and he does this ridiculous sort of, I don't want to say a curled backheel, because that's not what it was. He just dinked it in the far post from the keeper. It's just unbelievable what he did. Let me ask you something. Son's goal or Suarez's goal? Which one's better?
Great question. I am going to barely lean towards Suarez.
Why do you think?
Because the inventiveness, the idea of how few people would even try it.
Yeah, just the fact that nobody would even... Okay, so I'm looking at it right now. Oh my God. Okay, so it's a 1-2. He gives a 1-2 and he's driving away from goal.
Right.
And the 1-2 is with Messi, I think, right? Yeah. So he gives a 1-2 with Messi and he's driving away from goal. The keeper doesn't... No, it's not Messi. And there's a defender that thinks he's going to pass it down or try and shoot from the near post. So instead of like trying to go around the keeper near post, he backheels it far post. And like you said, the laws of physics should not explain that because Suarez is actually... Like the backheel should just basically be a pass and then somebody taps it in. But his backheel like...
But it hits the ground like near him first.
Yes.
The ball.
Yes.
So it goes downward on a backheel and then up.
And he does it first time. So it's not like he dribbles...
You know what the inventiveness reminds me of? There's this great God. Ronaldinho at the height of his powers goal for Barcelona when he flicks it. He's back to goal in the box.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Defender on him, flicks it, and somehow like defies the laws of physics and gets it over the defender, you know, like in himself and past the keeper. In South American, by the way. Just so you know.
So you may have a point.
Just so you know. And that... It's a little reminiscent for me.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I might have to go with Suarez as well.
Yeah.
It's just,
I don't want to, like, I feel like I'm saying negative things about someone's goal.
And we shouldn't compare them, but it's fun to compare them. Sorry. Anyway, amazing goal.
Which one of us do you think is better? Do you want to do, a stupid comparison? I'm sorry. Unfair comparisons.
Send the tweets over.
It's your favorite podcaster.
Yeah, I'll just get my whole family to send, and then I'll win.
So let's move to Germany, which, if there's chaos at the bottom of the table in the Premier League, there's chaos at the top of the table in the Bundesliga. We've got Bayern losing again. Seven-time defending champion Bayern Munich is now in seventh place after a 2-1 loss at Gladbach, which continues to lead the league. And you've got very much bunched up near the top here, a lot of different teams. Gladbach, Leipzig is on fire. Even Dortmund is now ahead of Bayern in the standings. They had a nice win over the weekend in some really sweet all-black shirts.
Yeah.
And I would say that if you're talking title contenders, Gladbach, Leipzig, Dortmund, probably still Bayern. Because in a weird way, Bayern has actually had two losses now in consecutive weekends. They lost to Leverkusen at home last weekend. And they've actually played okay. They created chances. They're just not finishing suddenly.
Yeah. I mean, you would think that, you know, sooner rather than later, they have to announce a manager. I don't know if that's just the only issue, but...
Well, at least they have the winter break, right? It's a long winter break, so I think I can see Flick going through the end of this first part of the season and then bringing in a coach.
That's interesting. Because you have the Champions League game, which obviously against Tottenham, and then after that it's Werder Bremen, Freiburg, Wolfsburg, and then they have the winter break. So that, I mean, that's three games. I mean, I guess you're right. I guess they have to wait no matter what for that winter break to like plan everything with the new manager. But here's hoping for their sake. I mean, two of those games are at home. So here's hoping for them that, you know, they pick up some points. Because like you said, I think the table is now representing the reality. Those are the top three best teams in the Bundesliga right now.
And Gladbach, let's give them some credit here. I mean, it was a late winner, but they were down 1-0 in this game, came back, and then they get Javi Martinez sent off for a bad tackle and then end up getting that penalty late in getting the win. So that's a team that I think it's fair to say nobody thought would be in this position at the beginning of the season.
No. I mean, we talk about the bottom half of the Premier League. Look at this in the Bundesliga. It's kind of incredible.
At the beginning of the season, you might remember when I did my thing right before the season started and congratulated on winning the title to Bayern Munich, PSG, Man City, Juventus, and Barcelona. Mm. Basically because they all had been repeat winners last year, and it really did seem like we had gotten into this rut. And here we are, and Man City not winning the league in England. Barcelona is in Spain. Juventus is not. They had their first loss of the season, but
and that was your guess. Inter Milan doing well.
So Inter Milan leading that league. PSG is leading in France, and in Germany, Bayern is in seventh place right now. Though they could come back. I mean, like, I still feel like maybe everybody but City could still win the league.
Yeah,
could.
Yeah,
still, I mean, this is surprising.
It's. I just the journey of respective leagues has been very interesting.
Yeah. Let's talk Italy just a second here. I don't like talking Italian soccer much lately just because I'm so disgusted by everything that happened. Because there's like, again, this week, Corriere dello Sport, one of their top publications, dailies for sports, totally racist headline for a story mentioning Lukaku and Smalling and just highlighting their race. Idiotically, so they get called out rightfully on that, and then they double down, saying that something's like a lynching, and like, you're done, Corriere dello Sport, you're done. And I still struggle with this, like, even talking about Italian soccer right now. Right?
Of course, because, listen, in one way, I don't like this whole overall pointing finger to the entire... Because right now what you're saying is the entire country is being blamed for it, right? Or like at least the overall. But Serie A needs to really talk about this, not just talk about it, but create actionable causes in order to rectify this. And now, as you said, major newspapers are not understanding what's going on. And it makes it extremely difficult to try and discuss this league.
Well, Clint Smith, who you should follow on Twitter, we've had him on the podcast as an interview guest, just is like, he tweets, I don't know how any black player could want to play in Italy. Like, why? You know, why? So Juventus does lose to Lazio. Lazio's actually doing pretty well, unexpectedly. Inter ends up tying in that game against Roma. So even though Inter dropped points, they end up gaining a point in the race. They're 2 points up on Juventus. And we'll see, you know, where things go from here in Italy. But, you know, Inter's put themselves in a position where, you know, they could be in the driver's seat.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, this is a good team that is doing, that's playing well. Again, they break up for play just before Christmas, 12-22, the weekend, a few days before Christmas Day. That's when they break Italian soccer, and then it returns again January 5th, and then Napoli faces Inter Milan in that weekend, so that should be a good one.
In midweek here, Inter has a chance to advance in a tough Champions League group with Barcelona and Dortmund. Inter's hosting Barcelona. But Barcelona's already advanced as the group winner, so they may not even play their best guys. I kind of expect them not to.
I don't think so. I mean, you have El Clásico coming up as well. You know.
Right, and so Inter has a real opportunity to beat Dortmund to the punch in advance. So yep. That would be big for them. Let's move to North America. I want to talk about U.S. soccer sporting director Ernie Stewart's comments over the weekend about this new policy requiring all coaches on the national team program, men's and women's side, senior national team coaches, youth national team coaches, to live in Chicago, where U.S. soccer is based. There are a lot of things happening with U.S. soccer this weekend because there was a board meeting in Chicago and some good reporting out there from it. Lots of things being discussed. The CEO search continues. That's been sort of ongoing and kind of endless. And we talked about how it really doesn't, that new CEO needs to come from the outside just because the culture inside U.S. soccer needs change. We also are starting to see some reports come out, Caitlin Murray today, about U.S. soccer's role with the NWSL.
It was one of our questions when I tweeted questions for us, so we can definitely address it.
In flux there. U.S. soccer has been operating that league that's supposed to end this year, but Caitlin's reporting that U.S. soccer declined a proposal from the NWSL owners to provide more money and funding as the league itself starts to independently manage itself. Counter proposal from U.S. Soccer, she reported, would be to continue managing the NWSL for another year, which hadn't even come up as a possibility. So lots to come there still. And then Ernie Stewart talks to reporters about this Chicago policy. And there's a few things about this, I would say. From my perspective. One is, I think you are going to limit the quality of potential coaches for your national teams by saying you have to move to Chicago. So, like, if you ever really do want an international manager, like a truly first-rate international manager to manage the U.S. men's team, and I'm thinking Pep Guardiola, I'm thinking Diego Simeone, any number of that type, they're not going to want to move to Chicago. And they're going to laugh if you tell them you have to.
I don't know what the thinking is here.
I think it's a power move by Ernie Stewart. I really do, because like...
So it's arrogance.
Power move, maybe. I mean, like, I think it's a situation where he wants to be interacting as the sporting director, the identity shaper, with the head coach every day. And you know what? Head coaches don't like that. They call it micromanaging. They don't like it. In fact, this has always been a problem in U.S. soccer. I can remember Bruce Arena during the first Bruce Arena stage when he got the U.S. to the quarterfinals of the World Cup in 2002 having major issues with what he called micromanaging from U.S. soccer on what he was trying to do. And he wasn't even living in the same city as U.S. soccer at that point and had issues with U.S. soccer meddling too much. So if that's the case, Bob Bradley had the same issues when he was the U.S. men's national team coach. And then Ernie Stewart has these comments of no club team in the world has coaches spread out like this. Well, you know what? This isn't a club team. Why are you comparing it to a club team? Why are you comparing this to the Netherlands, which is a tiny country? This is a giant country with players all over the place. And to require coaches to live in Chicago, which is really cold for much of the year, where there are no, like, there happens to be a U.S. soccer base of operations in this cramped old building in Chicago, but no U.S. soccer facilities, like fields and training centers and things like that, why on earth would you require coaches to be there?
Out of any country, the U.S. is the one place where you should not be restricted to location when it comes to scouting, development, et cetera. As you mentioned, you can't compare what's going on with U.S. soccer and its development with somewhere like the Netherlands or England. California State is bigger. You can't do that. You can't micromanage somebody, make them live somewhere, and restrict them from a job that they're trying to do, which at this moment, at its most important, is to discover talent that's more multicultural, from different backgrounds. And the moment you say you have to live here, you have to be here, like you said, many top-notch coaches are going to say this is laughable. This would be laughed in South America. Just like, are you joking? Europe, any other place.
And it doesn't even need to be Pep Guardiola that you're pursuing to have this feeling. Like, if Tata Martino, if they had been smart enough to actually be interested in interviewing him, if you had told Tata Martino, you've got to live in Chicago, do you think he would have done that?
No.
I don't.
Absolutely not. And we're not talking about Guardiola's. We're talking about any kind of manager with a reputation. Like, the moment you do that, you're already trying to pigeonhole them and restrict them from the overall job, which is to, this is a country where has so much talent, yet undiscovered. Why are you saying you need to live here, be based here? It's just ridiculous.
You know, if they were going to insist on, we all on the sporting side have to live in the same city, just have them in L.A.
Yeah.
You know, not Chicago. You don't need to have that connection to the bean counters at U.S. soccer.
It's just weird.
Ugh. Let's talk briefly. Liga MX final is set. Club America, Monterrey.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You know, Club America came back from the first leg against Monarcas and reached the final once again. So now we have Club America against Monterrey. It's a two-legged final, which will be played actually during the holiday week, the actual holiday week. I believe the first leg is even after Christmas Day, so that'll be interesting. And it's actually incredible for Monterrey right now. Rayadas, their women's team,
yep,
won Liga MX final against Tigres. Now they have themselves in the final of the Apertura. And now they're also getting ready for the Club World Cup. So, you know, it's a lot going on in Monterrey and this team. So, you know, it should be interesting to see, again, just how we talk about Liverpool and juggling everything, how they're going to juggle this. But, you know, well done, Monterrey. Both women's and men's, you know, doing great things. Women's winning the entire thing. So we'll see what happens against Club America. By the way, Memo Ochoa, who, you know, Club America's goalkeeper, had a rough middle, sort of, you know, halfway through the season, and it's good to see for him to, you know, get that final.
Question for you. With the trend of two-legged finals, like in the Libertadores final, moving to one leg, would you prefer in Liga MX a one-leg final or a two-leg?
I don't like two-leggers.
Yeah?
At all. Not with the final. I think that it's, with any kind of two-legged situation, you're trying to give advantage to something that doesn't need an advantage. Like, if you play it in a neutral spot with enough time to prepare, what's the problem? I think that the philosophy behind thinking that if you play at home, you're getting an advantage, I think that there's a difference between that and in a final when you can just, you know, ultimately decide who's the winner in a neutral situation. I mean, I get it. There's so many other things like marketing perspectives and, you know, financially it benefits both teams if you have your own home final. But, you know, a two-legged final just doesn't even aesthetically seem right to me. Just
I'm with you on that.
A one-off. Just as long as you have preparation enough time, you know?
A couple of quick things. Want to congratulate Stanford on winning the NCAA women's title on penalties against North Carolina.
Their goalkeeper, right? What?
Dude, what a gift.
Amazing.
And Stanford's got a lot of really good players who you're going to see at the international level as well, including for the United States. So congratulations to them. Also, this weekend, just wanted to congratulate the organizers of the Princeton Soccer Conference. I was down there on Saturday and Sunday. We're starting to see this more often where universities organize these soccer conferences. Yale did it earlier this year. Princeton did it this weekend. I ended up doing a couple of different panels. One was on women's pro soccer with a really good panel. Yael Averbush, who was on the podcast not too long ago, Brooke Elby from Chicago, who's the president of the NWSL PA. We had Tyler Lucy, who plays for Portland, Princeton student, a former Princeton student, and then Esmeralda Negron, former Princeton Final Four player, who now works for Relevant Sports, organizing the ICC Women's Tournament.
That's great.
A really good discussion about what's happening right now in the women's pro soccer sphere, sort of outside the U.S. women's national team, which I don't think people know enough about or enough people know. And then I did a Q&A with Charlie Stilettano.
Oh, Charlie.
The one and only. Which was a lot of fun, about how he became the best-connected American in European soccer. He organizes the ICC men's games every summer. And then I was also a panelist on a panel with Charlie and Court Jesk of the USL, and Sebastian Alvarado moderated that one, just about the future of soccer in North America, which obviously you could spend days talking about, but it was a good conversation. And then, yeah, a lot of good people down there. So,
yeah, it was great to see all the images. So, you obviously, and so many good friends. I was invited. I couldn't do it. My sister was here on the weekend. So I just ate a lot and drank and danced.
Awesome. That sounds like fun.
But no, all the images look good. And I think I'm with you. I like the fact that more universities and I want to see more, like, you know, high schools, you know, more of our media representatives and lecturers, et cetera, enter, like, high schools, especially in underprivileged communities, to just tell them, like, how great the sport is and how there is a job for you if you ever want to talk about it, report it, et cetera. So something to think about. I have one question from the tweet that I said, you know, anybody want to ask something? And Javier Campos, to both of us, who do you think is going to be the coach of Inter Miami? We've been dying to know for months now.
Sort of thought we would have known by now.
I know, it's kind of weird.
You know, especially because Jorge Mas keeps saying, oh, we're imminently announcing. You know, like, no, he's not. He never announced anybody. He's been saying this for months now.
Inter Miami knows its schedule from the opening weekend to the next weekend, and it still doesn't have a manager.
I mean,
their
training camp opens in just over a month, and they don't have a head coach.
It's crazy. I mean, it's obviously going to happen. Who do you think is going to be?
David Beckham at this point, because, like, they're running out of possibilities. I mean, there was reporting out there that Marcelo Gallardo turned them down.
I think he still sees that he has unfinished business in Argentina. And I don't think that the idea of, you know, the no relegation situation, maybe salary caps and travel, maybe kind of is impeding him a little bit, at least at this stage. We heard Patrick Vieira, too. Reports of that. I would really not like that. Nothing against Patrick Vieira.
Yeah, what's your problem with that?
I want to see a South American.
Okay. I mean,
it's me being extremely biased.
But, well, I mean, Santiago Solari was another name that got mentioned at one point. Then he said he really wasn't interested. So I know they want to make an impression, but get it done, guys.
It's just a bit weird that, like you said, the training camp begins in literally like 3.5 weeks.
Well, I went and I looked back at how much of a time gap there was. So if LAFC and Atlanta are sort of the gold standards for MLS expansion teams,
okay.
I wanted to know how much time had passed between the hiring of Bob Bradley and Tata Martino and when their first season started.
And
it was more like, I think for Bradley, it was like 6 or 7 months. And for Tata, it was actually fewer than I expected. It was like 3 or 4. And keep in mind that Tata, Paul McDonough, who's the Inter Miami personnel guy,
was at Atlanta
when Tata started. So maybe there's a little bit of a similarity of how he's approaching things there. But, like, yeah, get it done.
I just want to see it. But yeah, we'll find out soon enough, I guess. But David Beckham, that would be cool. If one day he wakes up and he's like, you know what, Jorge? I want to manage Inter Miami.
That was actually pretty good.
Yeah, I know.
Your impression.
I know, it was good.
We're going to do the whole next podcast with you talking in that voice.
Victoria, what do you think about Miami?
All right. That is it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care.